chapters of this book is available for sale up here or in my office later. It's also, I put it on reserve in the Physics and Astronomy Library, which is the POA. I don't know quite why Physics and Astronomy Library becomes a POA, but if you don't know where that is, you go into Bausch & Lomb off the quad, go up one set of stairs to the third floor, because you're coming in on the second. And you go down the hallway. Rush Reese is over here, so you want to... this is the front face on the quad, so you want to go down the hallway. And it's I probably have a number of other books. I think. I'm not sure if I did that or not. There are series of books that are relevant. How are things going? How are the rest of the day going? So last time we started talking about forces in fields. And so we're going to talk a whole lot about forces in fields through most of the course, actually. And the picture that we're going to look at now is one that I would call a classical picture, one that was used during from Newton on up through more or less 1930-40ish, when other views of force conceptual play a quantum view. But in this view, sort of think of action as being action, and in particular, we talk about gravitation and electric forces, which we'll find a little more complicated than just that. So, if I slip and call it electromagnetic force, you'll see why later. But for now, I'm going to use those words interchangeably. So, in the electric force, to say there exists something, electric charge, and you can isolate electric charge by rubbing dissimilar materials together. So in the atomic view, positive nuclei and negative electrons, and it turns out that different materials have a different affinity for the electrons. They're more likely to hold on to it or not. So if you rub the materials together, some of the electrons on one material can be transferred to the other material, making them have equal and opposite electric charges, and this is what causes static cling when you get clothes out of the dryer. This is what causes you walk on a carpet or something. You then build up the charge, and so when you touch something, the charge can fall off. This time of year, a dog or a cat shock their nose. Fundamentally, though, if you run very careful experiments and you quantify how much of this electric charge that you deposit on, and you look at how the force varies at the function, you end up with a formula that looks something like this. This formula consists of the amount of charge here and the amount of charge here, and you're looking at the force between these two bits of charge. Yes? Yes. Yeah, it's K times Q1 times Q2, the whole quantum divided by. Yeah. So you have the amount of charge here and the amount of charge there. So if you double the charge, you double the force. If you double either of these charges, you double the force. If you double both of them, the force is quadruple. You bring in twice as much in each. This is the distance squared, so it falls off pretty quick. If you double the distance between the charges, the force drops by a factor. And this K scale. If I decide arbitrarily I'm going to measure the charge in units of this, I'm going to measure distance in units of that, and now I'm going to measure the force in units of this, K is the number that you put in there so that it all, so that you can put an equal sign. Defines distance. Once I decide what units I use, like whether I'm going to use feet, seconds, and pounds for force, or whether I use newtons, different units of force, that defines sort of what I'm doing. If the electric force was stronger, K would be bigger, weaker, K would be smaller. So you can think of the sort of setting the scale of the force. So this is basically how one looks at the electric force. And identically, I mean, it's the same as we have gravity, except we have masses instead of charges. What's different is that in gravity, the charge, if you want to think of it that way, has only one sign. It's charge is mass, and it turns out that the force is always just attractive. In electricity, the charge can have either plus or minus sign, which means algebraically you either have plus plus or minus minus, which gives you an overall minus, or you have plus minus, which gives you an overall negative. I did that backwards, but I'm sorry. Plus plus minus minus gives you overall positive. Plus minus or minus plus gives you overall negative. And it turns out that if you have an algebraic negative sign here, that's what gives you an attractive force. And so whenever you write the force of gravity in a similar form, you're actually supposed to put a minus sign, which I'm sure I didn't do last time. But yeah.
Isn't that just the absolute value?
Here, yeah, right now we're really just talking about that. I'm just trying to point out that you can have it be repulsive or attractive. And how that comes about is by having different types of charge. So it's not that anybody came down from a mountain with a stone tablet that said that there exists two types of charge. Why we think there are two types of charge is because the force happens to sometimes be repulsive and sometimes attractive. And the simplest way to model such a thing is to have this type of thing where you have two types of charge. You could cook up more complicated ways of doing it, but science, which is you can create a lot of different explanations, but in the end, the one simplest that fits the data is sort of the one you go with. So it turns out that people did for a while think there was only one type of charge, and you sort of had an excess or a deficit of it, and that's what gave you the different charges. But in the end, was that there's a charge that can take two different faces. And now to map it into mathematics, you call that plus or minus, but that means you could call it red and blue. In fact, we're going to find when we do the strong nuclear force, which is a different force, there are three types of charge, and in fact we do call them red, blue, and green. Okay, so there was a point where this was completely arbitrary. I mean, you grow up hearing about it and sort of believing it as given, but this was just made up. It happens to work because we happen to have, it appears, two types of charge. There's also another experimental aspect about electric charge, which I'll just throw out here right now. And that is, if you were to take a pile of electric charge somehow and try to divide it up into smaller and smaller bits of electric charge, you get to where you cannot make it any smaller. There is a fundamental charge that's indivisible, which we actually call E for the charge of the electron. And you know why that is? It doesn't have to be that way necessarily. It's telling us something about nature that eventually I hope somebody will figure out. I mean, we do have theories where it pops out of them, and maybe this indicates support for those theories. But we say that charge is quantized, that there's a fundamental unit that you can have. You can't go any smaller. So that's just sort of a fact, but it's sort of irrelevant for what we're talking about today. Okay, so the problem with talking about the force, which, I mean, if I set out and I want to predict the future of a bunch of electric charges, what do I need to know? I need to know where they are right now, what their velocities are, and then if I know the forces on them, I can then calculate where they're going to be. So that's sort of the mission of physics, if you want to think about that. That means I need to know the force if I want to get their acceleration. So this is pretty fundamental. The problem is, in order for me to calculate what happens to Q1, I have to know all about Q2, because I have to know how far away it is and how big it is, and if there's some other Q3 or Q4 or Q5 or Q6 up here, I have to know all about them. And that is intellectually sort of a complex bit of baggage to carry around. So people come up with this idea called the electric field. So there's two ways to look at it. I don't care how it happens. It could be all sorts of charges out there, but there is a condition in space at a certain point, which I'll just call the electric field. The electric field is defined to be the force that a charge, if it were at that point, force per unit charge, where the charge here is the magnitude of this. Suppose I put a charge at this point and it feels a force going this way. Okay? The electric field at that point is defined to be that force divided by the amount of charge I have here. So basically, if a charge feels a force, there's an electric field in space in that direction, in the direction of force it feels. If there's no electric field in space, there will be no force on that charge. This is sort of by definition. That may sound sort of silly, but what I've done is I've divorced what's happening at that point in space from necessarily knowing all about what's going on out of here. So now we can actually talk about an electric field in space and talk about that without having to actually specify everything about all the rest of the universe and where the charge is. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is it gives us a mental picture of how to think about the force. So the way to do that is to sort of say, well, this charge sets up a condition in space, which we'll just call the electric field. And if this is positive, that electric field is coming out radially in all directions. And if I put a positive electric charge somewhere in that space, then the force that that electric charge feels is in the direction of the electric field of this other particle. So it gets pushed. There's a force on this. And the magnitude of that force depends on the size of the electric field and the amount of charge I put here. Yes?
When you refer to a charge, like, one of these dots is a charge.
Right? Yeah.
Well, what exactly? Is that like a charged molecule, or what is that?
I mean, it could be. I mean, I tend to think of it more like an electron or a positive electron. In physics, the most confusing thing to physics students when we're doing formal stuff on this, if you talk about electric currents and things, moving charges, what's really happening in the material is typically the electrons are moving, and I don't know, I mean, is this something that you just grow up knowing? Or do you hear about this in high school and stuff? Is that intuition that you get? I mean, for my physics students, usually it is. They just know that it's the electrons that are moving for electric current. So that means it's negative charge that's actually moving. And way back when people decide, oh, there are two charges, we have to call one plus and one minus. Ben Franklin actually chose the convention, and he chose it the wrong way. He had the positive charges moving. So it's a very confusing thing, because in the quantitative analysis of everything, we think of positive charges all the time. The direction of positive charge motion that gives you the direction of motion. But then you have this intuition knowing it's always the electrons moving, and so there's always confusion. Not necessarily. I mean, I could just pull out a proton here, a positive charge particle, pull out one here, and that's what I'm looking at. They don't necessarily have to be associated. Okay, so the idea is you can actually mentally figure out how the electric field goes. I could have out in space this particle. I can have, what does the electric field look like? Well, to figure out what it looks like, I can take a little positive test charge, we call it, and put it in space and say, does it feel a force? Well, if this is positive and this is positive, yes, this will feel a force being pushed away. So this one will feel a force this way, and I can then say, well, that's basically a picture of what the field looks like. If the force were bigger, I would draw the arrow longer. If it were less, I would draw it shorter. So sort of using that mental picture over here, for example, it would be this way. If I'm closer right here, because they're closer together, it'll be out radially, but it'll be longer because the force is bigger. So with that mental picture, you can actually sort of visualize the idea of the electric field in space around the charge. So positive charge, you have all these arrows going out radially, these being longer than those, because if you put a test charge here, it would feel a bigger force because it's closer. Here you have something very similar, but the arrows are going in. The positive test charge would be attractive.
So the electric force could consist of just the
it would take, you have to have two charges for there to actually be a force. One charge can have a field.
Yeah.
And you could say, if I know there's an electric field in this point in space, if I put a charge there, the electric field times that charge actually tells you the force. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So a field can exist without the force being there. A field can exist from a single charge or whatever. The idea is it's sort of a little bit mental trickery. This is totally made up. This whole idea of the field, and it's calculational convenience, and sort of there are some intellectual gains, because now I can talk about an electric field in space without really specifying what's going on with charges, and instead of studying the charge distribution, I can study the field, which turns out to be what people do in electricity and magnetism. They study the field. So it becomes a theory of electric field. So it's a little bit, I mean, really made up for calculational convenience. And I'm dragging you through this mud because there's some reality to it that I think isn't naively expected when you sort of just go about it. You know, if I have a positive charge and I take a negative charge and I put it right on top, then they'll cancel each other out. Yeah.
Oh, has their own field that you just did?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I have a... boy, that was a good lead-in, because I have a Java applet which illustrates this sort of nicely. But now I have to find it. Where did I tuck that? We ask them now. Okay. So what I have is a charge, and then I plot the electric field that, or the force that is on this particle due to that particle. So that's this arrow. And you can think of that arrow as sort of being a lot like. So if I'm closer, note that it grows, and it's always out radially. Okay, far away, you can't see it anymore. It's covered by the size of the particle itself.
Why doesn't the blue one have like a vector? Why isn't it also moving if they both have field?
Because I've defined. I've defined this to be the particle of the electron field I'm looking at. And this is my test particle that I'm moving around to see what is on it. Yes, there is always an equal and opposite force on the other side. Now, think of these things mentally as sort of somebody pushing so that the way they add together has directionality in it. We have to talk. There are three of us pushing it. If I'm pushing this way and somebody's pushing that way, they cancel out, right? And if I'm pushing this way and somebody's pushing that way, the box goes like that, right? So the same sort of thing happens here. I can now create a second particle. See, the electric field on this particle would give it a force this way. The electric field from the blue particle gives it a force that way. The two of those sum together, and this particle would actually move this way. So the electric field at the point would actually be in that direction. And mentally, sort of see how it goes. If I put this right in the middle, blue and the purple, the blue and orange are still there, but they now cancel out. There's no net force. The electric field is zero. If I move closer, blue is much bigger than the purple, orange. If I change the strength of the orange particle, so instead of being a charge of 1E, I'll make it some number of E. Then it now stronger, so the force gets bigger. So this is. This is a picture of the force. Let's actually look at the field. So if I have just this particle out in space, you can see the arrows, it's positive, so the arrows are all moving away from it. And as I move it around, you can sort of see what happens to this visualization of the electric field around it. If I increase its charge, it's going to make that electric field grow stronger. So, you get something like that. Okay. Now I can add another particle in here. And we can look at just the blue field. That's the electric field due to the blue particle. There's the electric field due to the orange particle. So remember, electric fields are like force per unit charge. They add together just like the force of two on the box. So if I look at the net field, I get something that's a little bit different, where they all add together in that weird sort of way. Okay. What other fun things can I do with this? You can add another particle. I can take the blue particle and make it negative. And things change. So. All right, so what do I really want you to do? I hope you're beginning to get a sense of creating a mental picture that around electric charges, at every point in space, there is something called the electric field. And the electric field is what actually conveys the force. But that's really just a quantitative trick. That's just a model. Okay? And the field itself really is a mapping of this idea at every point in space, where you literally associate this little arrow, and that little arrow basically is the direction and magnitude of the force on that particle that you might be expecting. Okay? So these more complicated distributions, basically we just solve this and forgot that. On the website, so you can play with those if you want. Okay, so that's basically an introduction to one of the four and fields and how people try to visualize. And visualize any force really in this way. So in gravitation, for example, we can visualize a gravitational field. If I have a big mass here, we can have a gravitational field that says if I put another mass here, it will feel a force in that direction. So you can imagine a little arrow toward the other particle. If it's closer, that arrow is bigger. If it's further apart, that arrow is smaller. Field would be just sort of this mapping of all the arrows, and it doesn't care about this other mass at all. So you can imagine this mass creates this condition in space, which is the gravitation. If I have a magnet, talk about magnetic. So in magnetism, there is one additional experimental fact that we just have to know. In electricity, I can have an electric charge where the electric field comes out of it, or I can have a charge where the electric field comes into it, sort of goes into it. But you can think of it as a source of electric field. You can almost imagine if you visualize the field as a fluid, you can imagine having a hose coming out that sort of sends water out in all directions, and you can sort of think of that as the electric field line. In magnetism, you don't ever have a single magnetic charge, which is called a monopole. In magnetism, as you probably know from playing, you have a bar magnet, it has a north pole and a south pole. The way to visualize that magnetic charge is, if I have a bar magnet sitting here with a north pole and a south pole, and I have a north pole and a south pole here, and the left-hand magnet is fixed, and the right-hand magnet is capable of spinning, what's going to happen? It's going to rotate. And the south pole is going to rotate, I'm sorry, the north pole is going to rotate toward the south pole. Right? So this is another example. The way magnetic field lines go is, ask yourself, what would be the force on a little north pole if I placed it, for example, here? It would be pushed away. If I placed it here, it would be pushed like that. If I placed it here, it would go like this. So in the same way that we sort of created a mental model of an electric field, we can create a mental model of a magnetic field. And the lines for an electric field, remember, we sort of had these lines going out like this from a single charge. Here, the lines actually circle around and come back like this. But it's a similar sort of thing. So the way to think about this is, if I put this magnet right here, this line would basically cause the north pole to be pushed this way and the south pole to be pushed that way.
Are there other any cases where one pole is stronger than the other pole? Is that possible?
Not if that's all that's there. You could have the magnetic field sort of go and do something else over here and make it weaker here, but it would require other stuff over here and here to do it. But if all I have out there is if I create a magnetic field, I have a strong north pole and a south pole that are equal in the same.
South pole.
Yeah. If I broke this in half, I mean, it might weaken the overall field, but it'll be symmetric. Why is this? In fact, most physicists don't like this for reasons I'll point out to you. And the fact that we don't have magnetic monopoles will play a very important role later on in the class. It turns out that one of the huge conceptual jumps in cosmology came about from the fact that we have to have a universe where we don't see magnetic monopoles. It turns out that in the early stages of the universe, you can't avoid making them. So where the hell did they go? And so people came up with a scheme that sort of makes them go away, which turns out to be a very important scheme in cosmology.
So that's the magnetic question. It's just like...
Well, that's not a force. You can only have a force, just like with the electric charge, you can only have an actual force if you have two charges. Here, I'm not writing down the formulas, because they look a little bit, they're a little nastier than the electric force, but you have to have the two magnets, basically, to have a magnetic force.
So the two poles of one magnet don't interact with one another?
Not really. I mean, they're part of the same thing. It's a. I'm exerting the force with both my hands, but I don't go anywhere. Because basically, this one exerts a force that way. So I can't think of it that way. Okay, so there exists, just like there exists an electric field, we talked about this in a magnetic field that typically has some weird sort of shape like this. It never has a source or a sink. That's fundamentally different from the electric field. But otherwise, you can sort of visualize the magnetic field in much the same way. Demos I wanted Monday, and the demos I wanted today, I guess we're going to have Monday. Now I have to think about how I can see what I have is a piece of plastic with little. I don't know what it is. There's a liquid in there, and there are little granular pieces of something. I don't even know what it is. But it's a non-conductor. That is, it doesn't conduct. The charge does not flow through it. But if... If I have a space where I have an electric field, and because I'm going to write it all the time, I'm just going to tell you this, it's not obvious. When one symbolizes an electric field in physics, we just give it an E. Okay, so if I just talk about E, it just means that electric field. The arrows over on the left represent a visualization of the electric field in that region of space. The E means electric field. Arrow on top of the E symbolizes it as a vector. It's not necessary to worry about that in this class, but I'm going to habitually do it because I'm so used to it. So all that really means is a quantity that also requires direction. So the electric field has a direction. If there's a force, it'll have to be in some direction. So we have an electric field. If I put a material, a bead of material, in that electric field, charge flow at all in that material, then there's a force on the charge in the material, and some of the positive charge will actually go to one side, and the negative charge will go to the other side. And if I have another bead of material, it'll do the same sort of thing. But now notice that within these two nominally neutral little beads of material, I have created a situation where this positive is going to actually attract that negative. So the beads of material will actually move toward one another a little bit. Here, so you can think of these as point charges, and that should create an electric field in the space around here. And then one hopes to see if I put positive here and negative here, then here in the middle, I'm going to have things. The electric field is going to be going from here up to there, and over here, this one will be pushing it out. This one will be pulling in. So the electric field will be going like that, straight up, and over here, straight up. As I get closer to over here, it'll be going in. Closer over here, it'll be coming out. So this is the positive and negative charge that we've seen earlier. So that's what it ought to look like. Now, let's see what happens to the little beads of material if I place charge on these two things. So just watch the little dots. See them starting to move in here now as I put more and more charge on this piece and that piece. And now notice how they're lining up. They're sort of lining up along the direction of the electric field in those places. So along here, the electric field is like this. Out here, see, it sort of moves like this, if you can visualize that. You good with that? It's cool. Do this differently. Field going to look like now? I put a bunch of positive charge here and a bunch of negative charge here. Imagine what would happen if I put a positive charge right here in the middle. It would just be pushed from this plate up to that plate. So you're going to see an electric field that ought to be going from one plate to the other like that. Okay? How to line up. See? Is that cool? See the electric field sort of run radially out to here. Sort of see the direction that I'm moving. Okay.
see how. I thought it was like really inconsistent field. I figured it would be symmetrical, like down, you know, down the middle, just because like the charge was in the middle, and the two shapes were symmetrical.
Round one.
Yeah.
Well, there was a hole at the top, so that's going to create an asymmetry.
Okay, I don't know.
Here it's more or less radial. There's no field in here, so these didn't move. And up here things get all screwed up because you basically don't move. So that was sort of what I
was. Why is there more concentration on the leg?
That's just because when I shook it up it was random.
Until like some sort of
Well, there's the electric field is going to line them up, but if they have more beads over here, more will be lined up over there, just because that's where they get stuck. I mean, I don't... If the electric field is this way, there's nothing to move these over here, I guess, to make the symmetry, if that makes any sense. So basically, they get stuck on whatever radial line. So you have more over here, because that's where I just ended up with more, random. Now I run into trouble because what I really want to do is to do several demos that I have the wrong ones for, so I have to decide whether I want to make a break or go ahead and tell you what you'll see in the demos, but we do them Monday and then do the flow the right way. Okay. We're going to pretend that we have the demos. This is going to seem a little bit disjoint, sorry, but we're going to come back to electric and magnetic fields. What I want to do at the moment is to take a break from fields, and I want to make an actual change and talk about waves and what we need. Okay. So waves turn out to be really important, and they are intimately connected with matter and all sorts of things. We'll talk about the waves as the course goes on. But let me start. Would you all do me a favor to stand up where you are? Okay. And then, completely randomly, as you choose, you would basically just up and down. You can do it fast, you can do it slow, Lovely. Okay. I'll keep doing it at whatever speed you want to do it. I mean, this is my favorite part of class, by the way. All right. Now, we're going to change things a little bit, okay? I'd like you to think about what you were just doing. Right now, what I want to do is to have you stop. And I'm going to walk this way. And when I am directly in front of you, I want you to start low and do this. Okay, I know, it's a total interference. Alright? And then, sort of at this speed. Okay? Okay? What do you see? You saw a wave. Alright, so the Super Bowl's on Sunday. I'm sure you've all watched the football game before. And the crowd packs Bob, right? Everybody, the stadium wave gets going. You can see the stadium wave goes, right? So what's the difference between a crowd in the stadium sort of standing up doing this randomly everywhere and the stadium wave? What makes it a wave? It's like this connection from one point to another that connects a simple motion, which is nothing more than an up and a down, periodically. Okay? But if you do it randomly, it's random crowd. But if they're connected together, right? Which in the stadium way, you do by the timing and the synchronization, when you don't go up, the person beside you has gone up. A second later, right? So that's what gives the synchronization. That's what makes a wave. But each point on the wave isn't going anywhere, even though the shape moves and it can carry energy, actually. But the points on the wave don't go anywhere. So in the stadium wave, you haven't gone anywhere yet. Across the stadium, they see this beautiful wave flowing across, right? So, if it's a straight, okay, and I have a rope here, right? If I have a taut rope and I do this, then you can visualize this sort of pulse moving down the rope, right? That's a wave. Why does it happen? Because when I displace the piece of the rope up this way, it's connected to pieces here that get displaced. And then when I yank it down, it starts pulling these down. But because these were on their way up, they have a piece of the rope going up. And now they're on their way down, they start to pull it down. And this whole shape basically just propagates along this wave, this stream. Okay? The same thing happens in water. If I dump a big brick in a pond right here, okay, it pushes water down and up on the side, but the water is basically connected to other water molecules. So if I put high water over here, what is it going to do? It's going to start rising over here. And so you get a wave that way. Sound waves are vibrations in the air. So these are all forms of mechanical waves. I want to talk about the pieces of the wave because we're going to be throwing out a lot of this language about waves throughout the course. So we can imagine having a stream, and let's suppose I take a stream, and sort of a long stream, and I just do this, same height, and I do this periodically, harmonically, so that the timing is the same all the way. So what will happen is you'll get successive waves just going down the stream. It's going to look something like this. You can imagine it moving in this direction. I'll give it a V that shows you the direction it's moving. And I want to put measurement axes on this so that we can talk about it a little bit quantitatively. So imagine that we have frozen time for a moment. I'll call this the x direction and this the y direction. A much deeper wave, if you want to think about the much different height and trough. So we call that distance the amplitude. And it's the same for all of these. And it's a measure of how high from have the wave. Note that as the wave is traveling, it's periodic in shape. You have this, and it comes back to where it was here, and then it starts over again. And that happens again and again. So this length of the periodicity, you can think of it from this point to that point, or from this peak to that peak. Doesn't matter. We call that the wave. I don't know if we're going to do that much with amplitude, but often with amplitude, you know, maybe I might call it an A. The symbol for a wavelength is typically the Greek letter, small Greek letter lambda. Now, if you imagine that we have on this string, I tie a little bow, say a tie. Little bow tie there. I want you to understand what happens to that bow as this wave rolls past. Okay? The bow starts out here, and as this piece of the wave hits it, the bow moves up as this crest moves past. Okay? And a moment beyond where I've currently got it pictured, this piece has moved here and the bow is up here. And then a split second later, this piece has moved and the bow comes back down. Then it comes back to this point. And then this piece of the wave is the piece that's traveling through here. So the bow starts moving down to this point. So when this piece of the wave has reached this point, the bow is down. And then the bow comes back up to where it started. So the bow itself, just like a first and second wave, just moves up and down. Okay? And it will move up and back down and then back to where it started in the time it takes for one full wavelength of the wave to pass by. You okay with that? That amount of time, the amount of time it takes for that boat to basically go up, all the way back down, right back to where it started, or a way to visualize it as one full wavelength of this wave to go by. Call that. So this goes up, back down, and then back up to here in one period, which the symbol we use is T, T per period. Don't ask me that. We will not talk about period all that much because there's a little known fact about physics that we're really good at, which is it's all about job security. There are certain things that you do, and I think probably physics isn't alone in most every area. There are certain times when you have a perfectly simple concept and you use lingo or whatever and disguise it. And it's a form of job security. So we don't really talk about period because it's sort of good. And frequency is equal to 1 over the period. So frequency is a measure of how many times per second the bow goes up and down. So if I have a wave that has a high frequency, the bow is going up and down a lot as the wave passes. If it's a low frequency, the bow goes slowly. A way to think about it is if the wavelength is really short as the wave passes by, if it's staying at a certain speed, then the bow is going up and down a lot, so you would say it has a high frequency. If the wavelength is really long, it takes time for the thing to pass through, and the bow only goes up and down very slowly. Okay? And the relationship between the wavelength and the velocity of the wave, if the wave is going really fast, then the bow is going to go up and down faster. So there's a fundamental relationship. Now, the frequency, as I say, it's all about confusion. We give it a symbol, which is the Greek letter nu, if it's light. And sometimes you'll see an F if it's sound. Typically. There's a relationship between the velocity and the wavelength and the frequency that is pretty fundamental, and we'll use it in this class, which is the velocity of the wave is equal to the wavelength times the frequency. And just maybe because this will help make sense for some of you, velocity is a measure of speed, so it's distance per time. So in units, if we do units of meters, for example, this would be meters per second. A frequency is a 1 over a time. So this is a 1 over a second. And the wavelength is distance, so that's a meter. So the units on the two sides. Yeah. If I were to write down the gory form of the mathematical form of this wave, it would have in it something that would determine the direction along X that it's actually going.
And would a wave that comes out from one point have to flow?
It also would have a direction, a wave to flow in a direction, and that directionality is in the
mathematics. But would it flow in every direction?
Well, if you had a source, like something made a big sound right here, that vibration out isotropically. Or if I had a big flash bulb that would hit there, when we think of light as a wave, it would go out isotropically. Isotropic meaning in all directions at once. And if you wanted to describe that wave mathematically, you would have to have that information in there. Now, that actually turns out to be really nasty. We're better off with the light in a very small way than we could with the other wave all moving in one direction. It's a terrible thing. So if I throw a brick in right here, what you see is this wave front moving out in a circle, and that's really hard to describe mathematically. But if I go, it has to be a hell of a big bridge. If I go 100 yards down the pond and see that wave go by the time I'm over there, it just looks like a flat wave front coming by, because you're basically the circle becomes so big that I perceive it as being flat. It's like that says sound, and this says for light. So this typically frequency has the symbol people use nu, usually if they're talking about light, they use F if they're talking about sound. And it's another really nice way to continue. This one turns out to be something we'll see some. Okay. So those are sort of the components of a wave. And waves have very particular characteristics. Waves exhibit several fundamental characteristics. One is known as interference. One is known as diffraction. And one is known as refraction. And so I'm going to illustrate these individually, but let me quickly tell you what they are. Interference is a way that the amplitudes of waves add together when waves hit each other. So an example of that's interference. So an example of interference. Have you ever been in the ocean and you see a big wave coming at you this way and sort of another wave coming at you this way and they're out of space? This crest hits you when this trough hits you, and you end up basically not feeling much of anything. They cancel each other out. But sometimes you'll have a big wave crest hit you when another wave crest hits, and you get a much bigger wave. So that's the way the waves add together. Same thing happens on the screen. So you can imagine having a string like so with somebody on one side and somebody on the other side. This is sending pulse down. So I have a pulse going like that and a pulse going like that. When these two pulses pass through each other, you get a much bigger pulse for a moment, and then they basically will pass through each other like so. This would be particular characteristics. If these two things, if one of them is the opposite way, so I could have, for example, these two pulses, they hit each other, you'll get nothing for a moment, and then one moves past the other. Literally. So in the case where they add together, people call it destructive interference. In the case where they can't add, they call it destructive interference. Diffraction is how waves spread out when going through small openings. And refraction is when waves bend at a surface. A surface that they may be able to pass through. So I'll use demos. But refraction is what we call the way that glass, for example, can bend light, which is very important to you if you wear contacts or eyeglasses. Have you ever played with a magnifying glass to burn hands? None of you would do that. I mean, I'm the only mean person in here. That's good. I'll be worried about this. You know, we have light coming from the sun all in a straight line, and you have the glass of a certain shape that bends the light in to a point, and that's how you can manage to cook things. So that phenomenon is fractional, and it's a little less obvious that you see it also in sound, and you can see it in water waves. Here is what's called a wave tank, a ripple tank actually. And I have water on a glass surface, and I'm projecting up through it, and where the water gets a little thicker, it'll seem a little darker. So now I have a device here, which is a long bar. Is these waves are coming and they go through a thin slit here. Look at the pattern of the waves as they come out of that slit. You see this? They spread out as if this were a point. And that is known as the phenomenon of diffraction. And if you take a look at aerial views over, you know, waves incident on some port that has a nice breakwater with a small opening, you could actually see this type of thing happen. So this is known as diffraction. This basically is why you can hear around corners. It's a light wave phenomenon in one direction. If I make this narrower, the spreading out is a little bit more pronounced. If I make it less narrow, the spreading out is a little less pronounced. Okay? Now, imagine what would happen if I have two sources of waves. Sometimes the wave from this source will add to the wave from this source, and sometimes it'll cancel. So you'll get constructive or destructive interference between the two waves depending on the relative distance you are from these two sources. You okay with that conceptually? I'm now going to create two different sources by creating two small holes where the waves can come through. See some sort of lighter and darker bands coming off here. Can't see it all that well. Thank you. I'm not getting it to show up all that well. I'm moving this out. Sorry. What maybe you see is that you can sort of see a lighter piece and a darker piece and a lighter piece sort of coming out like this. What's happening is this wave and that wave interfere, and in some places you're going to get it darker, in some places lighter. So you can sort of sometimes see these striated patterns. They aren't showing up all that well. Well, sometimes it works really well. Crests would sort of add together, which if I'd done this nicely, you'd sort of see these patterns of radial lines sort of add together nicely in places and subtract out in others. It's a demonstration of the fact that the wave. And waves satisfy certain mathematical equations, and from those you can derive these characteristics. So these are basically a wave. Must exhibit these characteristics. Anything that exhibits these characteristics is a wave. Okay. I have a similar demo here, which a laser light passing through a couple of thin slits. Are close enough together and small enough, it sort of creates a similar sort of thing. Alright, so I have, there's just a laser straight up. If I send it through a single thin slit, the slit is end-slit like this. And note that the laser beam, which was a round dot, got spread out left to right. That's a phenomenon in light. And it is a demonstration that light turns out to be a wave. If I now send it through two slits, in addition to the light being spread out, you should see light from one slit interfering with light from the other. And you may or may not be able to see it nicely, but what I'd like you to do since class is basically over is on your way out, just come down and look. And what you'll see are light and dark fringes here. And those fringes are pattern of light from one slit against another slit. And on your way out, there's a reflection of light coming from this that's headed right there. So when you're about halfway up, don't turn around and look into it. It's not good for you. Alright, so we're done for today. At least come up and see that you can see the light and dark. Superimpose the one slit, so that's why you get a lighter here. You get it spread out. It sort of turns out even with two slits, you sort of have a superimposed single slit pattern.
Well, I don't understand why is there so much dispersion.
This kind of stuff is scattered.